This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading research medical schools. Icon Mount Sinai is the academic arm of the 8-hospital Mount Sinai Health System in New York City. It's consistently among the top recipients of NIH funding. Researchers at Icon Mount Sinai have made breakthrough discoveries in many fields vital to advancing the health of patients, including cancer, COVID and long COVID, cardiology, neuroscience, and artificial intelligence. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way.
Before the show starts, I'd like to ask you to consider subscribing to News from Science. You've heard from some of our editors on here, David Grimm, Mike Price. They handle the latest scientific news with accuracy and good cheer, which is pretty amazing considering it can sometimes be over 20 articles a week. And you hear from our journalists. They're all over the world writing on every topic under the sun, and they come on here to share their stories. The money from subscriptions, which is about 50 cents a week, goes directly to supporting nonprofit science journalism, tracking science policy, our investigations, international news, and yes, when we find out new mummy secrets, we report on that too. Support nonprofit science journalism with your subscription at science.org/news. Scroll down and click subscribe on the right side. That's science.org/news. Click subscribe.
This is the Science Podcast for May 22nd, 2024. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, hope in the field of deadly prion diseases. Prions are these misfolded proteins that clump together and chew holes in the brain. The misfolding of these normal proteins can be switched on in a number of ways: genetics, spontaneous folding, and infection with a misfolded prion from another animal or person. Staff writer Meredith Wadman walks me through new potential treatments for these always fatal neurodegenerative diseases. Next up on the show, producer Catherine Irving talks with researcher Ashley Larson about the effects of organic farms on their neighbors. If there are very few organic farms, conventional farms actually tend to increase their pesticide use. But if organic farms are clustered together, the pesticide use goes down for everyone. Prion diseases have a very strange mechanism. Prions start as a normal protein with a normal function in the brain. These prions can misfold or adopt another shape and then cause other prion proteins to also misfold. These misfolded proteins accumulate and slowly, surely destroy the brain. Neurodegenerative prion diseases like Creutzfeldt-Jakob in humans and bovine spongiform encephalitis in cows can actually infect others in certain circumstances. Like you might have to eat part of the cow, and there are also certain ways for humans to pass this to another. No matter which way you get it, there's also genetic versions, it's 100% fatal. Attempts to find treatments for prion diseases have really been stymied since the discovery of these mechanisms in the 1980s. But this week in Science, staff writer Meredith Wadman wrote about new tactics to take on prion diseases that are giving hope to researchers and patients. Hi, Meredith. Welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Sarah. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you. Although this is a pretty intense story. You have a lot of people that you talk to that are either had this disease or studying this disease because they have family or enrolled in the trials. It's an impactful piece for sure. In fact, I first heard of this story on the Science Slack channel 4 months ago. You wrote on there, "My friend is having these really weird symptoms. He's in the hospital." Do you want me to read your Slack message? Would that be weird?
Sure. Yeah, no.
Okay. Do you want to read it or do you want me to read it?
Go ahead. You can read it.
Okay. So I see the Slack message from you on one of the news Slack channels. "For any of you disease sleuths out there, a personal question. We have a good friend, 67 years old, in Arlington Hospital since Sunday, with progressively worsening confusion, now hallucinating. He has left-sided weakness. His MRI shows something going on in the right temporal lobe. No recent travel. His last travel was to England in March. In a stretch, the stump doctors are testing for CJD. They have also just requested a neuro consult from the Mayo Clinic. I asked if they have tested him for Eastern equine encephalitis, WNV, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, herpes simplex, cryptococcus. Is there anything I'm missing? I didn't ask about malaria. There was recently a case in Maryland.
So this is you reaching out to our science new staffers who have explored all aspects of disease and biology and saying, who can help me figure out what's going on with my friend? And of course, it turns out it was the super unlikely CJD, which is a prion disease.
It was. And I got to correct myself, my Slack message in two elements. Number one, Charlie was 70, not 67.
Yeah.
And number two, my sort of know-it-all-ish saying, in a stretch, they're thinking about CJD. And of course, you think about what you know. And even as a medical student, years ago, CJD was so rare. Like, it is rare as a physician that you will see a case in your life.
Yeah.
So I was kind of like, what?
It's not easy to diagnose, right? Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, what we're talking about. It's a prion disease. It's the human, one of the human forms. It's not easy to diagnose. It's very rare. Like, people are not coming down with this. And the only way to tell often is in aftermath, right?
Oh, the only definitive diagnosis is from a pathology in a brain autopsy. So yeah, that's the for sure method. Although there's some very good diagnostic tools, one in particular now, that give a lot of certainty. But that's not going to change the course of the disease, which in almost all cases is very rapidly progressive. Our friend Charlie died about 5 weeks after he showed the very first symptoms.
Yeah. Was that what made you decide to write the story?
Certainly got it on my radar. And then in discussing with one of our editors, John Travis, what was going on, because this has been a uniformly bleak field for having treatments. There are none. He and I kind of came across several potential treatments that are progressing.
Yeah.
And one just happened to be launching. The first clinical trial in more than a dozen years started in January. So it seemed like an auspicious time to be writing about this.
There are different sources of prion disease. So for example, I mentioned the cow form was transferred to people through diet in England during this huge outbreak. But nowadays, how are people getting prion diseases? How can someone end up with this kind of misfolding protein accumulating in their brain?
Right. So if you think about all prion disease as pie, there's a tiny sliver, less than 1%, that is acquired by eating contaminated meat or by having a surgery, a neurosurgery in which a contaminated instrument was used. Something external to your body comes into it.
The case we heard about a researcher in France in the last couple of years who had a needle stick from, you know, working with prion proteins.
Right, exactly.
Super rare.
The whole pie is ultra rare, is a bunch of ultra rare diseases or super rare.
Yeah.
And the acquired kind is like less than 1%. So, and just to put it in context, in the US, there have been 4 cases of acquired from infected cattle disease ever since the British outbreak. And 3 of those had traveled abroad.
Yeah.
And one of them possibly had traveled, they had picked it up traveling. So this is not something homegrown where you got to look at US cattle, say, and say, ooh, I better not.
Right. So what do we have left in this pie?
So 10 to 15% of the pie is genetically acquired prion disease. That's where you inherit a mutation, and these are dominant mutations, which means that if your parent is carrying the mutation, you have a 50% chance of getting it from them. And then if you do inherit it, you have a 100% chance of developing the disease. It's not a matter of if, but when. Then finally, you have these 85% or 90% of people who just develop it. They call it sporadically, consider it spontaneously. This protein goes rogue. That's much more likely to be in people over 60, so related with aging, perhaps. It's not well understood why these proteins, regular, normal prion proteins, which inhabit all of our brains, suddenly just misfold and go berserk and basically chew holes in the brain.
How easy is it to study interventions in this population? You know, you have your people who have the spontaneous form, you have your very small slice of genetically predisposed. How do you enroll people in a clinical trial if they're already kind of on their way in a short-term disease to death?
Right. So that is a key hurdle. One clinical trial that just launched in January, the first one in more than a dozen years, that is randomly assigned, very carefully controlled, the kind of trial that produces evidence that FDA would look at and say, yes, we'll prove this or not. It's the first stage, but the company, Ionis, that developed this drug hopes to be able to win an FDA approval. But they're testing it in people with acute disease at this time. And so they have a small window to find these people. People bounce around from doctor to doctor. No one knows what's happening. The symptoms look odd. Doctors haven't seen this by and large, and it's really tricky to diagnose. So by the time there's a presumptive diagnosis, there may be only weeks left for that patient to live. And so you've got to get them enrolled in that trial very quickly. The median survival time for Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, the most common of these prion diseases, is 4 to 6 months.
So the clinical trial that we're talking about here that's kicking off is using basically the fact that this is starting as DNA, going to mRNA, and then going to protein, and trying to interfere in that process by introducing an antisense oligonucleotide. So a little strip of DNA that will go and find the RNA before it gets turned into the protein.
That's exactly it. Antisense oligonucleotide, ASO for short.
And how does it get into the brain?
It is injected into the spinal fluid near the base of the spine, and that fluid is contiguous with the brain. It bathes it, and it goes into systems inside the brain, and then the ASO is believed to track along the small arteries and get into the brain tissue. There's a question about how deep, and distribution is one of the challenges, actually, with this approach.
Is it one and done, or do you have to keep injecting people with this?
They need repeated injections at intervals of weeks. That's what this trial is set up to do.
Mm-hmm.
This stage, which is a first-in-human trial, they're testing for safety and for how the drug is metabolized in the body to get to appropriate dosing levels.
Are they also looking at some other endpoints? Are they looking to see if they can decrease disease markers or something?
There is a biomarker in the cerebrospinal fluid that can be followed by collecting it at regular intervals, which I believe this trial will do. And the biomarker is basically the normal human prion protein, because what this ASO intends to do is shut down production of normal protein, because without normal protein, then the misfolding can't happen.
Are people okay if they don't have any of the normal protein?
Several animal species have been engineered to completely lack prion protein. And even though it's abundant in the brain and serves lots of different functions, it's thought, these animals have been fine. There's one issue in some of the older mice with a peripheral neuropathy that develops with time. But, you know, the risk-benefit ratio for humans is pretty clear.
What about in people? Are there people who have had, like, none of this?
No, but there are a few adults who have been found who had only half the regular allotment. In other words, one of their genes wasn't functional for normal prion protein, and they were found in late middle age or as elderly people, and they had had kids, and they didn't seem to have any problems.
Yeah. So that's one approach that's being tried, and it's moved into clinical trials. There's also these other approaches you talk about, like zinc fingers.
Yeah.
That's something I know interlocks with DNA, but that's all I got. How does that work?
Yeah, if you picture the sort of progression of prion disease, starting with the DNA being transcribed to make messenger RNA. So the DNA is the first step. That's where zinc fingers attack. And they are naturally occurring proteins that a company, Sangamo, has tailored to attack specifically prion DNA and prevent it from ever being turned into mRNA. So that you're way upstream of the protein actually being produced. Now, it needs to be said, Sangamo is in animals still. They're not in the clinic like Ionis is with their ASO. So then if you move to the right along this timeline of protein production, you get the mRNA, and that's where Ionis's antisense oligonucleotide attacks. And then if you move just a little further along to where the polypeptide chain of the protein is being made by a ribosome that's glued to the endoplasmic reticulum where final protein assembly steps happen, that's where yet another approach works, being made by Gate Bioscience, which would be a pill to take to block those final steps of production of the prion protein. Again, all three approaches are trying to just zero out prion protein, because without it, you cannot have misfolding.
That is a question, though, like when this intervention would be ideal, any one of these blocking the production of prion proteins. Would you want it if someone had genetic testing and saw that they had a prion protein mutation that was going to lead to misfolding? Would you want to do it super early?
Oh, yes. And that's something I meant to circle back to when you asked about the very different approaches to the clinical trials. This is not a prevention trial that's currently going on. But that is the aim of Ionis, is to get to where you can identify people carrying the genetic mutations who have a certainty of developing prion disease and treat them years or decades ahead of the disease developing. And one of the biggest advocates and real workers in the trenches to make this kind of trial happen is Sonia Vallab at the Broad Institute, whose mother died of a prion disease at age 52, and who herself has inherited the mutation that caused that disease. And she is working feverishly with her husband, Eric Minicol, and lots of other collaborators to get to a point where you could have a therapy that would zero out prion protein production given preventively to people who are bound to develop the disease but do not yet have symptoms.
And just to reiterate what you said, these people changed their careers because they realized that she had a prion disease. They went and got PhDs and they became part of the research community, and they are a big motivator behind a lot of the work that's being done and driving some of the funding, because this is a super rare disease. It's a very hard target to hit. It's fast moving. And yet here we're seeing, you know, a real forward momentum in the field that you kind of would think would be pretty abandoned or orphaned.
Yeah. And a lot of that is to Sonia and Eric's credit. And of course, to the prion research community more broadly, who have really rallied and worked with them and been very, I think, moved by Sonia and Eric's motivation. And Sonia and Eric are involved not only, you know, they did preclinical work for Ionis to get the current trial launched, but they're also working with Sangamo to test the zinc fingers. And they're working with this company, Gate Bioscience, which is developing that pill I alluded to that would shut down the final stages of prion protein production. So they got fingers in lots of pies, and they are just wickedly smart and so motivated. They're really extraordinary people.
We talked about some of the hurdles. Getting patients, getting these materials into the brain is always a challenge. And then also zeroing out prion. There's just a lot to overcome to make this work. Have we seen any success in other diseases with some of the approaches that you're talking about today that are being tried for prion diseases?
Yeah, so Ionis, the company that made the ASO that's now in a clinical trial, has had mixed success developing ASOs for a number of neurological diseases. They had one for Huntington's that was a big disappointment, but they had one that they developed for a very small portion of ALS patients that got approved by FDA last year. And perhaps most noticeably, they had an ASO approved in 2016 for spinal muscular atrophy, this rare inherited disease that cripples kids from the very earliest days of life. And that is being widely used. So there have been some successes.
That's great.
They're also at work on one for Alzheimer's. So stay tuned.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a really good segue. This brings up something that I think came up in your story, the idea that, you know, this is a rare disease, a very specific mechanism at the beginning, but, you know, the formation of aggregates is common to other neurodegenerative diseases that we know about. Is Alzheimer's a disease that might benefit from our understanding of prion diseases?
Absolutely. And also Parkinson's. I mean, there's misfolding of proteins that then form aggregates that then do brain damage in both those diseases, which particularly Alzheimer's is clearly much, much more common. And Parkinson's is not uncommon either. The learnings and the applications of what's learned in this trial and in prion disease approaches generally definitely could have relevance to these commoner neurodegenerative diseases.
Okay, Meredith, before I let you go, I just wanted to circle back to kind of what we started talking about, which is your friend Charlie. He was a journalist. He was writing a weekly column about the community that he lives in. And then he's hit with this like slew of strange symptoms. And even to the last, you know, he did not survive very long past when he was diagnosed. He still continued to show how much he cares and contributes to the community around him. And this just really comes across in the way you write about him.
Yes. Charlie, when the doctor diagnosed him, this was like 8 or 12 days before he died, he reached out and shook his hand and told the doctor congratulations for solving the mystery. And then within a few days, he made very clear that he wanted to donate his brain for research. And the one place that collects all the brains of people who died with suspected prion disease in the United States is the National Prion Disease Pathology Surveillance Center at Case Western Reserve University. And that's where Charlie's brain is.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, that is also the first trial site in the current trial. So I was able to go out and meet Brian Appleby, who directs the surveillance center and also is the main investigator on the clinical trial. And it just so happened that the day I was there, he got the results from Charlie's brain that showed that Charlie had not had a mutation that he might have passed to his daughters, that it was sporadic.
Oh, wow.
And that he'd had a certain gene variation that made it very rapidly progressive. And it was really moving. And Brian said to me, after talking to Charlie's wife, Ellen, that he had learned that Charlie was a journalist. And wow, what a great final contribution this was to be part of this story.
Amazing. Meredith Wadman is a staff writer for Science. You can find a link to the story we discussed at science.org/podcast. Stay tuned for producer Catherine Irving and researcher Ashley Larson. They chat about the spillover effects of organic agriculture. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology. Are you or one of your colleagues doing great neuroscience? If so, then we encourage you to apply for the prestigious Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology, an international prize which honors young scientists for outstanding neurobiological research based on methods of molecular, cellular, systems, or organismic biology. Submissions are due June 15th. Visit science.org/Eppendorf to apply today.
I think most of us have heard of organic agriculture, but what we probably don't know is that what happens on an organic farm doesn't necessarily stay on that organic farm. What goes on an organic farm could actually affect how surrounding farms take care of their crops. This week in Science, Ashley Larson and her colleagues report a discovery about the spillover effect of organic farms onto non-organic farms. Hi, Ashley. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So your paper, as I just mentioned, talks kind of a lot about organic agriculture. And I think a lot of us have an idea of what that is. But just in case, can you give us sort of a quick explanation about this method and why some might consider it better for the planet, quote unquote?
Sure. So organic agriculture is a production system that generally relies on more natural production methods. So in the U.S., organic agriculture is governed by the National Organic Program. And particularly when we think about pesticides, it often means they're relying on more natural pest control methods. So not necessarily no pesticides, but generally no synthetic pesticides except those that have particular exceptions.
You talk a little bit in the paper about your environmental footprint. How does it kind of affect that?
A lot of people think that organic agriculture is basically one potential solution to reduce the environmental footprint of agriculture because of this reliance on more natural production methods, particularly, again, related to pests and pest control. The big picture, and particularly when we account for yield differences, the environmental impacts of organics are not fully understood. And most of that research has happened at the field scale. So comparing organic and conventional fields with respect to biodiversity or soil quality or economic outcomes, social outcomes, et cetera. But when we think about pests in particular and their natural enemies or predators, right? These are mobile organisms. And so what happens or the decision made at the fields might have impacts for their neighbors. And that's really what we're trying to get at here is we're interested in studying whether organic cropland has these spillover impacts for nearby growers.
So if this method is considered more environmentally friendly or more sustainable for the land, is there a reason why we don't see it super often? I think it only makes up about 2% of global agriculture.
I think it is growing. But of course, there are different challenges. Some of it might be economic, some of it might be just farmer behavior and knowledge. There are different structures that result in sort of the land use trajectories we see today.
You talk a lot about spillover from these farms in your paper, but what is it that's spilling over? Is it pests, pesticide usage?
So we're thinking particularly about fields. You know, a farmer can have multiple fields, but we're thinking about those field interactions in space. And so, as I mentioned before, pests and natural enemies of pests, which are a wide group of different organisms. We can think of insect natural enemies like beetles, for example, ladybird beetles. We can also think of parasitic wasps. We might also be thinking about spiders. We might be thinking about birds. We might be thinking about bats. There's a huge variety of different organisms that consume insect pests. They're mobile organisms. And we think that they respond to both local and landscape characteristics, field size or presence of hedgerows, or in this case, the question was organic agriculture.
So how would you expect this spillover to influence surrounding growers?
There's both an ecological and an economic aspect to this. And I'm an ecologist, so I think more about the ecological aspect, which is exactly the pests and predators and their movement in space and how they're impacted by these local and landscape characteristics. On the economic side, and my colleague, Frederick Nowak, who's co-author on this paper, is an economist, but we think in economics that farmers might also interact, right? It could be that this change in pests that are spilling over onto your field affect your pest site use decisions. It might be that you spray more in response to pests, but it might be that there's just such an influx of pests that your benefits of spraying are actually reduced because you treat, but pests come back. And so perhaps you actually spray less if your neighbor sprays less. And lastly, it could be that you just learn. You look over the fence and you see that your neighbor is doing something different and you learn from it. And so these different fields give us these different hypotheses about how organic agriculture and the landscape might affect a nearby growers. And that's basically what we're trying to get at with these spillovers. Because your decision to produce organic affects something beyond the boundaries of your field.
Mm-hmm. To do this, you analyzed a lot of data that was in Kern County, which is in Southern California. Was there a particular reason you chose this area?
Yes, there are a couple reasons, right? One is that Kern County is a really interesting agricultural system. It's often either the top or top couple agricultural producing counties in terms of value. It also grows a wide diversity of crops like almonds, pistachios, these high value, high pesticide use crops. And so it's a really interesting, intensive, diverse agricultural system. And then on the more practical side, it's also a very data-rich system. And so it's a place where we have field-level pesticide use data, we have field-level crop and farmer information, and we have information on certified organic agriculture. So it sort of all comes together that we have good data and we have an interesting system. And so it seems the appropriate place to focus our attention.
You were assessing a couple of questions. So you were looking at how organic farms influence other organic farms, how they influence non-organic farms, and then also what specific pesticides or things they were causing to change. So how did you go about measuring all of these questions and these impacts?
Sure. So the first aspect was really identifying where organic agriculture was. And this is actually quite tricky, even with all the data I mentioned, because we have information on where certified organic agriculture is, but often we don't know the exact field. And so we need to understand, well, which of the potential fields are organic? And so we have to bring in some of that pesticide use data to identify which potential fields only use approved pesticides or no pesticides in order to identify which ones are actually organic. And then once we know which fields are organic, then we can measure how much organic agriculture is surrounding each of the roughly 14,000 fields that are permitted in Kern County each year. And that's basically how we build our data set. And then we rely on a series of mostly panel data models, trying to leverage this multi-year data set and account for things like farmer-specific behavior, crop-specific heterogeneity and pesticide use, year characteristics that might affect all fields within the system, and some regional aspects such as soil quality or something of the sort that might also interact with both organics and pesticide use. And so our main results rely on these panel data models, and then we do some simulations based on those results.
So what, if anything, surprised you the most about the results that you got?
It's a great question. The honest truth is the whole project was pretty exciting and surprising. We hadn't looked at the spillover effects for organics before. So, you know, the most exciting part was just getting our initial results and then trying to turn over as many different rocks, so to speak, to see whether they were robust as we could. And the truth is we were, I think, riding pretty high the whole time because it was such a novel project for us.
Yeah, and it kind of seemed like you got some two sort of related but different results where organic farms together, there were decreased insecticides when there were lots of them that could be together, but it seemed like the non-organic farms were increasing their pesticide use when surrounded by organic farms, which is a fascinating result.
It's really interesting. As mentioned a little bit earlier, there's some different ecological and economic underpinnings to this research. And in the economics literature, we might actually have anticipated that Sure, farmers might increase their pesticide use in response to increasing pests, but if there's all this spillover, they might actually decrease it in sort of a race to the bottom. Or they might just look over and look at their neighbor who's organic using less pesticides and try it, right? Just learn their neighbor. In both cases, we'd expect a decrease in pesticide use on conventional fields. And we actually see an increase. We basically hypothesized that it's due to different reliance on natural enemies or natural predators of pests, that on organic fields, there's perhaps a larger population of natural enemies that are available to sort of quickly control these incoming pests, whereas on conventional fields, that natural enemy community is lacking. And so if there's a spillover of both natural enemies and pests, conventional fields perhaps either have lower spray thresholds or receive more of those costs because they don't have the natural enemy community.
And so how do your results connect to that distribution of organic and non-organic farms?
Basically, our simulation suggests that low levels of organic cropland, that effect on conventional dominates. And so we actually have an increase in insecticide use relative to if there was zero organic. But as organic becomes more prevalent in the landscape, we see a decrease, as you might expect, because we start having more of those organic on organic impacts, as well as the direct effect of organic on insecticides. And so basically, if you cluster, then you sort of harness all the benefits of organic on organic, and you minimize those costs of organic on conventional. So by spatially separating organic and conventional fields, you basically get less pesticide use on both conventional and organic fields.
What testing did you do to sort of come upon this result? Did you use models? What sort of techniques did you use?
Basically, we did this by building off our Kern County analysis, a slightly different analysis, saying, how does increasing the amount of organic from zero to 100%, basically, around each field, and as a total amount of the landscape, right, how does that influence insecticide use? And that's basically the hazard model. The cluster model is basically doing something very similar, but now we're changing the number of organic and conventional fields and basically saying, if you're conventional, you have all conventional around you. If you're organic, you have all organic. I'm trying to understand the difference in simulated outcomes as a function of that dispersed versus clustered. And of course, the real world is neither entirely dispersed or entirely clustered, but we wanted to understand sort of the bounds of the different difference in the insecticide use response.
Mm-hmm. And so that organic on organic together, is it because there's more natural enemies sort of switching over all the organic fields, or why did they together have like a net more positive impact?
That's what we basically hypothesize, is that by having a more of a landscape of reduced synthetic pesticides, that we might imagine there are more natural enemies in general. So even if there's a spillover of both pests and natural enemies, there's natural enemies persisting in the landscape to address the spillover of pests. But it is important to note that we don't actually have pest or natural enemy data. So we're inferring this based on prior literature in agroecology in particular, and it, of course, additional work on the ground would be extremely valuable.
And so how do you hope that these results that you're getting could be applied towards, you know, agriculture or land management? Like, how can they inform that going forward?
How we're thinking about it is basically there's a lot of interest in organic agriculture. It's increasing quite rapidly as an industry, but also there are different policy pushes to increase organics in the coming years and decades. Like the EU's Farm to Fork program, as well as the California Air Resource Board, has some targets in their scoping plan, right? So these are major initiatives to increase organic agriculture. And the question is, that we are trying to get at is, are there some unintended aspects that we should understand as organics might be increasing in the landscape? And so from the policy perspective, it suggests that thinking about these potential unintended consequences and how we might mitigate them by spatially clustering or incentivizing some type of spatial clustering of organic agriculture as it continues to increase in proportion in many places, right? That would be one way to leverage these results. When we think about farmers, if their neighbors are rolling out additional acreage of organic cropland, maybe they should pest scout a little bit more. Maybe they should think about their planting decisions. I'm sure they already are, but these are aspects where it might be valuable to think about these spatial dimensions that connect fields in an agricultural landscape.
Ashley Larson is an ecologist at the University of California, Santa Barbara. You can find a link to the paper we discussed at science.org/podcast. Thanks for coming on the show, Ashley.
Thank you for having me.
And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. To find us on podcasting apps, search for Science Magazine, or you can listen on the site, science.org/podcast. This show was edited by me, Sarah Crespi, and Kevin McLean. Special thanks to Catherine Irving for her segment on organic agriculture. And we also had some production help from Megan Tuck at Podigy. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.